And here we go. This is the Sutliffian Report, and today we are going to have a guest with us, Eric Rizzo. We're just waiting for him to sign on. But as this is a Christian news show, we always start with a passage from the Word of God. Now, just a second. Let me get to where I got to get here. Okay. So today we're reading from Matthew 26, verses 1 to 5. And it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said unto his disciples, you know, that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified. Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people unto the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people. This passage speaks of the plot to kill Jesus. This is the third time that Jesus speaks of the betrayal to come in the book of Matthew. And while they abode in Galilee, Jesus said unto them, the Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men. That's Matthew 17:22. And in Matthew 20:18, it says, behold, we go to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death. Can you imagine being one of the 12 disciples and hearing this not once but three times? Well, knowing that Jesus has to be speaking about one of the 12 who has been with him for almost 3 years. People you have eaten with, slept with, laughed with, celebrated with. People who have been empowered with the authority of Jesus to heal the sick and cast out demons. Yet Jesus, who has never been wrong once ever, is saying this for the third time. But this time, he says, when? Part just gets me. It's going to happen in 2 days. Your mind would be screaming, no! Every fiber of your being would be on alert, because if they take him, what would they dare to do to you? Most of the disciples were known for not being learned men. They did not have the analytical mindset that schools attempt to raise up today. Maybe they thought it would be someone just outside spying on them. This also would make, you know, sleeping hard. How do you sleep knowing that this is going to come to pass? If Jesus said something, it was 100% true. Yet sleep would have to come because it was still just a few days away. The passage includes the plotting of the chief priests, the scribes, and the high priest Caiaphas, the chief chief priests and scribes had been called what they were, hypocrites. Caiaphas and them had lost the income from the money changers. Jesus thought, though he is the Messiah, could have destroyed them. They knew it. In many ways, he had. He took on who they were privately. He exposed them. I'm going to mute you for just a second. Okay. All right. He exposed them. And that's what really bothered them at the most. Could anyone now trust them? Jesus was there. The Messiah had come. What value would they now have? A plot hatched to protect themselves required the blood of the very one sent to be the sacrifice for their sins. Dear Lord Jesus, you are the great and mighty King. You know all that will happen. And yet, you still allow us to make choices. And us guys, we make the stupid choices. We always do. We do the stupid things. And you can, women, you can just ask us if we do the stupid things. We'll just sit there and laugh because we know. Lord, I thank you, Lord, for giving so much love that you're willing to accept us. And we don't deserve it. Lord, just use us and help us to reach the lost. In your name, amen. Wow. Now, Eric Brazo is in the house. Thank you for joining us. And Eric is a new, I would say, an author that is really kind of blowing my mind right now. He's a warrior for truth. And I think the way he puts things is unique. And I think it's incredibly important that we listen to his perspective. I shared a little bit with the members on the panel, and I think people will just, I personally can't wait for your book to come out, Eric. I personally can't wait.
You're
going
to have to.
I'm hoping maybe a month or two, not 3 or 4 or 5 months, because this is, I think this needs to be read, and I'm just kind of, I'm not going to give all, I don't want to give it all away, because there's a lot more here than share. But if you have any questions, you can post them in the chat room while you're listening. We'll see if I can post them too. But I want to start out with Eric. Again, thank you for coming back to the show. Because we have a growing audience, and I am now back on LinkedIn where I'm promoting this, I have over 18,000 connections there. So we're going to see if this audience starts to grow. Let's see. Can you start by telling everybody a little bit about your background?
Sure. The audio is okay. You hear
me? Oh, it's perfect.
Well, how far do we go back? I guess we're talking about in the confines of understanding Islam, correct?
I would go to the confines about what got you to.
So after 9/11, I was a bit of a contrarian, and I just took the other side of the argument, but I understood no way we could actually defeat terrorism. I didn't think it was possible to defeat terrorism at that point. I came to Toronto in 2002, New Year's Eve 2002 when I moved to Toronto.
Yeah.
At that point,
how do I
didn't know
move?
Much about Islam, other than I had some friends in Toronto who were Muslims, three of them, used to hang out, they worked in my company, we smoked hashish together. They were here directly from the Iran-Iraq war, so this would have been in early to mid-80s. Few years goes by, I'm here in Toronto doing my thing, working in a business. I'm in a restaurant on Parliament Street in just south of Dundas. I'm talking, chatting with some Muslim cab drivers, and I mentioned, home. This is, I'm not sure if you're aware that the Ontario government was considering introducing Sharia law tribunals for family court.
Yeah, I did know some of that. I've been paying attention, trying to. I'll be honest. I will tell everybody this. What got me the most today when I was talking with Eric earlier is how close he pays attention to us. And the honest truth is, I'd say a lot of Americans, we need to pay more attention to what's happening in Canada right now. So yeah, I pay attention because it's across the lake from me, but not as much as I should. I'm sorry. Thank you.
In this restaurant, we're talking about this or that, can't remember. And then grunted out, well, of course, nobody wants Sharia law in Canada. To which they got very angry and said, yeah, of course we want Sharia law. Okay, then, you know, smiling. I thought that was a joke. And again, I'm waiting for them to smile or laugh. At that point, I understood it's possible that there are Muslims who want to bring Sharia law to Canada. And that's when I started on my journey of listening to YouTube, mostly. I got obsessed. I was listening to 2-3 hours a day, you know, Middle Eastern, Qatar, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, all of it, Palestine, Yasser Arafat. And then Hillary Clinton apologized for the innocent of Muslims and the whole Benghazi affair. And that sent me over the edge. I said, I cannot let that stand. And we're apologizing for a film, which is part of free speech, free expression. So I made flyers, highly offensive flyers, and gave them out specifically to Muslims and in downtown Toronto and to left-wingers and put it at Dundas Square. A week later, I was arrested, charged with a hate crime. Initially, they wanted to charge me with conspiring to commit genocide. And off we went, and that's where it all started. And then I was in jail. And being in jail for 8 months, I had time to read the Quran 8 times from cover to cover. And I copied it out on paper. So there I was in myself, some days 8 hours, 10 hours on the weekends, writing out in hand, in very neat printing, all the many of the verses in the Quran. You know, when you write something out, you end up understanding it better, that you get etched into your mind. And I became somewhat of an expert or an authority on what's contained in the Quran. And I could recite, you know, verses for half an hour, verbatim, word for word. Then I understood that it can be said that because I am not a Muslim, I am misinterpreting the words in the Quran. Of course, it says what it says. We know what it means, but that's what we call it. They set up a straw man argument, a fallacy. They say, well, it could mean something else because you're not Arabic and you're not an imam or a Muslim. You might feel misinterpreting the Quran. So I realized that's an argument that can be made. And then we start arguing about whether or not I'm understanding the Quran. So I decided, let's forget that. And now I do not try to understand the religion of Islam. I do not pay attention to the Quran. I try to learn and share what it is that the experts and the authorities and the imams and the sheikhs are saying Islam is. If I'm at this, I bet I could be misinterpreted. Okay. I don't need to know what the Islamic doctrine is saying. What I do need to know, what we need to know, is what are they saying Islam is. And if they say it, well, it must be true. Simple.
That's quite an important impact. We have to listen, and I think that is one of your big cries. We have to listen to what the purveyors of Islam are stating about Islam. We have to listen to what the imams say. We have to listen. There are times, I would say in general, we have to listen to what they're saying and be careful of, while we listen, but we have to pay attention to what they're, especially what they're saying to each other when they think they're only talking to other Muslims. Your book, your new book, it centers around two progressive or moderate Islamic views. You use the term progressive, which I think is really interesting. These are expressed by Irshad Manji, which for many, they don't know who she is, and Zuhdi Jasser. Why did you pick these two people to highlight and discuss their views of Islam?
They are the most visible. They are the most significant. They've written books, given many interviews, as well as you could say the most credible. Whereas Jasser is a surgeon, doctor, medical. He was a medical surgeon and represents the doctor for the judges in the Supreme Court. So that makes him a very important, smart, intelligent man. And then you have Irshad Manji, who was a professor, was a speechwriter for the political party here in Canada. And they are, both of them have founded, Irshad Manji founded the Moral Courage Project. She's worked at two different universities. Yasser Qadhi is founder of a website, of the movement called the Islamic Forum for Democracy, or some such. And so they are the most prolific and the most well-known. So they embody the reform, progressive, freedom-loving, LGBTQ-loving Islam that everyone, all Democrats, nice people, leftists, or just nice people, want Islam to be. So if Islam was what they say Islam is, that would be beautiful. That would be wonderful. So the question is it? To some extent, maybe it is, but then to some extent, maybe it's not. So I look at the two voices to understand who really represents not the true Islam, but who represents the vast majority of those who believe what the true Islam is. So, for example, there was a man here several years ago. He was on a Greyhound bus, and he understood that the guy in front of him was the devil. And so he actually beheaded him on the bus. True story. Probably the guy that he beheaded really wasn't the devil. And he's now in a psychiatric ward, etc. Doesn't change the fact that the guy who was beheaded is still beheaded. And the consequences are the consequences. Was he right? Was he wrong? Is he true Islam? Is it true devil? Did he behead the right person? Was he hearing voices? All of that is an issue that can be discussed. The bottom of the line is he did what he did because he believed what he believed. So the young Chechen boy who beheaded the teacher in France, he might be wrong. Was he misinterpreting Islam? That's a question, that's an issue, we can discuss it. But according to him and to his immediate community, to his parents and his brother and his cousin, he's a hero. He did the right thing. And then the same thing happened to Theo van Gogh. Van Gogh, in Holland, he was beheaded in the street, shot, and then beheaded. Was the guy who beheaded him representing a false Islam? Was he misunderstanding, misinterpreting? Could have been. However, he still did what he did based on his belief. So we need to understand what are Muslims believing. not whether or not the belief is right or wrong, but what is it that people believe? What is it that the vast majority, the 97% of believers who believe Islam, tell them to believe?
I think that's an interesting point. What is it that the leaders tell them to believe?
Sure. And we have to accept that most people do believe what the leaders tell them to believe. That if you're a Christian and you're going to church, you will be influenced by the priest or the rector who preaches, you know, the sermon every once a week. Otherwise, why would you go to church and why would you do the sermon if it had no effect on you? Correct?
Correct.
Otherwise, he's not a very good priest, isn't he? It's a pointless sermon. So, imams preach to affect the congregation. Some they will affect more, some they will affect less, but they are affecting them to a large extent or to a less extent. But they are affecting them. Simple.
Next question, which I have to say, the joy in knowing some writers is I get a sneak preview sometimes of what's coming out. And Eric, the manner in which you use words to communicate is masterful in this book. I mean, this is, I'm just going back and looking at this and I'm like, wow. I mean, I've seen you grow through this book. Wow. That's all I can say. It truly shows growth. Chapter one in this book is titled, A Muslim is Not an Islam. Nor is Islam a Muslim. Now, that should make you think by itself. In this chapter, you dive right into the most important questions. Here you state, inevitably, after every jihad attack committed by someone who identifies as Muslim, the mainstream and alt media will spin one of the two familiar narratives. Either way, they will say, this Muslim killed these people because his religion, Islam, is evil, or else, the man is known to have mental health issues and does not represent that peaceful religion of Islam. Repeating these two polarizing narratives does little to uncover whichever unconscious bias has been drummed into society. Eric, can you please tell us more about these narratives and the problems they cause?
Sure. Narratives allow us, to some extent, lazy intellectually.
I love that. It's truthful.
Because I could just chalk it up to one side or the other. And then the individual now no longer has to think, no longer needs to bother to exercise their mental capacities. People, they have to work, they have to take their children, they have to drive traffic, they have to, you know, there's a lot of things pulling at their lives. They don't have time to spend or invest to delve into what is the underlying basis or foundation of what's going on. So, depending on whether or not they know a nice Muslim or whether their best friend is anti-Muslim, they will be on one side of the fence or the other. And that's where they're going to stay. And it's easy. So every time there's an issue, they could just go to one side of it, they just pick or choose their preferred narrative, and that's where they live. And that's what they talk about. Now, I'm not going to say that the truth is somewhere in the middle, but it's not so much about truth as it is, if I could use this in a court case, the important part of what the judge does after you're found guilty or after he finds you guilty is he has to lay out the groundwork and how he came to his decision. He writes it all out. Now a judge can come to the right decision for the wrong reasons. He can find you innocent or guilty. But based on all of the presuppositions and all the laws that he laid out, this case, that case, he has to lay out how he came to that decision, because that will then be the foundation of what he uses to come to future decisions based on similar circumstances. So if people are lazy, either they're lazy or they just don't have time, it allows them to come to wrong decisions or right decisions, because sometimes even a clock is right twice a day, right, a broken clock, so they can, by chance. So, as I say in the book, you can meet a very pleasant Muslim in the elevator on a daily basis on your way down to the lobby. That doesn't therefore mean Islam is a pleasant religion, just because a Muslim happens to be pleasant. Neither is the inverse. If you met a Muslim who was having a bad day and he was very rude and angry, does that mean Islam is therefore a rude, angry, unpleasant religion? Of course not. So we need to get away from all that. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. Maybe I'm just rambling. Sometimes I'm just rambling. It really comes down to you need to get away from labels. And I think I'm leading into what might be your third question. People talk about an extreme Muslim, moderate Muslim, extremists, and moderates. And we need to get away from that for the simple reason everything is comparative. Correct?
Yes, yes. We have to have something to compare something against, yes.
Sure. So depending on what you compare it against, therefore that again makes it either moderate or extreme. So that, again, it doesn't matter if someone is a moderate Muslim or an extreme Muslim,
I'll be honest, I hate the word extreme, but I do like the way you put it. Because I don't see, when I talk to Muslims, they all tell me there's no such thing as extreme Islam. Every Muslim I meet tells me that. I do meet people that talk closer to your terminology. I haven't heard mainstream, but I like that term because it makes more sense to me. And you mentioned, this is what I like. In your book, you use the terms mainstream Islam and progressive Islam. Until I started reading the material you put together, I'd never heard of the concept of progressive Islam. But I like this terminology because it makes a lot of sense. Can you tell us a little bit more about that terminology of progressive Islam and mainstream? I know you just started to get into it.
Yeah, sure. Actually, mainstream was used by Irshad Manji herself.
Oh.
She was being interviewed, I read it in the book, by the name of Steve Brett at the university, an interfaith, and she herself said and admits that she is outside of the mainstream of Islam. And she herself says that Bilal Phillips, Raj Wahaj, et cetera, that they are the mainstream. In the sense that the word mainstream means what? What does it literally mean, Paul?
Mainstream, the average
literally, what is the mainstream?
The majority, I would say.
No, it's just the mainstream.
Okay. Oh, okay. It's mainstream. Okay.
The mainstream of water. It's not
tributary. Yes.
90% or 95% is the mainstream. Everything else is a tributary. It could be Ahmadiyya, et cetera, et cetera. Those would be the tributary. Mainstream is Sunni Islam. Sunni and Shia is your mainstream. Then we can get into subcategories of the Sunni, but that's irrelevant. The relevant is self, Sunni, and Shia are your mainstream. Irshad Manji admits she's not in the mainstream. Jasser admits he's not in the mainstream. So, if Bilal Phillips, are you familiar with Bilal Phillips?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so if Bilal Phillips is mainstream, why would someone say he's extreme or extremist? It's the mainstream. You can say, perhaps you don't Islam, or I prefer not his version of Islam, but you cannot deny that his Islam is mainstream Islam. I might not like Pope Francis, what the Pope is saying now, I might not like his version of Catholicism. So it would be difficult for me to argue that his Catholicism is not the mainstream Catholicism. Well, follow what I'm going.
Yes.
If the majority of Catholics believe, you know, such, well, then that's what they believe in. That's the mainstream. And we're not talking mainstream 51%, 52%. We're talking, you know, upwards of 80%. Hands down is mainstream. Everything else represents 3%. Vershad Manji and progressives represent a tiny fraction, like a tiny, tiny percentage. And progressive was also used by themselves, the reformers. They used terms of reform, progressive, and they like to use also liberalized. Now, a man who also uses this in a mocking manner is Daniel Hakikaji.
That's true.
He mocks the idea of progressive, reform, and liberal. So my book is geared toward the average person who wants Islam to be reformed, who knows some very nice Muslim people, who's involved in interfaith bridge building dialogue, to understand, well, what is the reality of what's going on here. I went on Amazon today just to take a look. The preponderance of books, by far, are either written by Muslims who, you know, try to expose Islamophobia and how America, Canada, and Europe is unnecessarily Islamophobic, or you have rabbis, priests, etc., who write the preponderance of books about how to better do interfaith dialogue and how we're all going to rabbi each other and get along. But no one is actually looking at what is the reality. What's real? Not what we want it to be. Not what you would like it to be. But what is it? I use the example in my book. If I'm crossing the street, I have a green light. A truck coming the other way, cross, you know, for whatever reason, wants to brake, but he's, you know, honking his horn real loud. And I said, I'm not going to move because I have the right of way. Runs me over. A couple hours later, they're scraping my brains off the pavement with a spatula. But I was right. I had the right of way. He is wrong. I am right. To some extent, that's what we are doing. We keep going on about, well, this is America, this is Canada, this is the West, this is what it should be, what they're doing is not fair, the media is doing this. I mean, okay, but when they're scraping our brains off the sidewalk, we can complain and say, well, it wasn't fair, it was a good system. We're in the right, it shouldn't be this way, well, but that's just the way it is. And we need to start facing that and accepting that and embracing it. Not just tolerating it, but embracing it, because you can't do anything other than embrace reality. And you can't. It's not possible.
In chapter two, which, again, I love the names you put for these chapters, too. I don't know if your editor helped you with that or what.
No,
but
nobody helped. That's all.
Wow. Okay. So fasten your seatbelts, people. Hear this. Listen to this title. Islam is not monolithic. Controversy in diversity. Okay. I just love the way you put this. so you said, again, again, the word play in here, I love it. Again, it had me, I just reading this section, I started to fall on the floor laughing because it's so good. You have a section in this, and it says an apple, a banana, and an orange are different. But when you compare them to a stick, they are the same. I'm sorry. As a teacher, I keep thinking about how many times I'm trying to get something through to a kid, and I'm trying to, I have to keep digging deeper and deeper until the kid has something that can relate to the material. And, that's what it comes down to. This is a stick. It makes a lot of sense. And I don't know where you got this from, but it's powerful. Oh, wow.
If I may say, I spent a lot of time in scouts by myself, locked up, days and days and weeks and months and months, doing nothing but thinking about all of this issue, the subject. So that's where all this comes from.
I'm going to share this next piece that I have in this quote that I want to put it up on the screen. So I want people to see the kind of wording you do, not just hear about it, because this, I think, is very, very powerful. Here we go. Put it here. Okay. You wrote... Right-wingers ask sarcastically whether diversity is really strength. How did this phrase become a truism? If diversity were strength, then people would know it to be true, and the government, institutions, academia, and the media would not need to be constantly shoving this down our throat. For some inexplicable reason, no one, not even Justin Trudeau, Canada's prime minister and a champion of diversity, has clearly explained why diversity and ever more diversity is strength. But in fairness, this is to Prime Minister Trudeau, no one has ever directly asked him this question expecting an answer. So let us construct three scenarios in which diversity is not a strength. One, should a chain supporting a crane or some great weight be made of uniform links of the strongest metal, or should the links be diverse in size, made with a diversity of materials? I want you to think about that. I'm definitely not getting underneath that crane carrying whatever it is, if they're made from different things. I like this one too. The ball bearings in a wheel must not be diverse. Now, I have seen people substitute things, and that doesn't turn out well in the long run. If you're an auto mechanic, anybody here listening know more about cars than I do. If you have a car, you probably know that's quite a statement about how the ball bearings and the wheel cannot be diverse. How about this one? I like this illustration a lot. I don't live too far from Gené Nuclear Power Plant. A nuclear power station is going into critical meltdown. You can choose one of two groups to attempt to prevent this. One diverse group of 10 people contains two nuclear engineers, three clowns, two bartenders, and three humanities professors. In this second group, are all 10 are nuclear engineers. Which ones are you going to choose? Is diversity our strength in the... Yeah. I love it, Eric. You couldn't have put it better. Can you just comment a little bit more on this? Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure what to comment. It's pretty obvious. It's simple. And I've had conversations with strangers, people on the bus or acquaintances. And when I ask them about diversity, very often they just come back with, well, diversity is a strength. Because it's good, and because diversity makes us more diverse. People have no idea what they're saying. It's almost to the point where it's an absolute psychosis.
That's
Nobody can answer that question. There is no answer to that question because diversity may not be a strength in and of itself.
That's very
That now is what's become. So if I went to an area that had, say, we, a group of us, were going out to the and there was an area of town that had restaurants all next to each other, like the restaurant area. Now, that would be good to have a diversity of restaurants in this area. That's good. And Italian and Greek and Lebanese and Thai, et cetera. But can you say the same for chain? It depends. So sometimes perhaps you like diversity, but diversity is in itself not a strength. It can be a preference. Again, you had a Socrates, you had an army, which you want. You know, one army of strong, muscular, aggressive, macho soldier types who are, you know, alpha personalities, or an army with, you know, sensitive, emotional, caring.
So you sound like you're trying to describe the new military in the United States.
So the question is, it depends on what is goal that you're trying to achieve.
Yes.
Is it to win your soccer game? If you wanted to win the soccer match, you get the best soccer players.
But even within the first illustration, it was a great illustration. So, yes, it's nice to have a diversity of restaurants in your area. So you go to the Chinese restaurant, and inside the guy who's cooking, you have somebody from England, you have somebody from Africa, and they don't really know how to cook the food because it's not their background or... Is that a strength? And that's, yeah.
You might want a whole bunch of Chinese people cooking Chinese food, or five people cooking Thai food.
In general, that's what you want because you know it's genuine. That's in general. I'm saying there are exceptions to those rules. There are always exceptions to those kind of things. Or if somebody's learned those things, yeah.
But Paul, the way we approach diversity is the answer for... when taken for granted that it's good, is the same for everything that's affecting our civilization. Again, it comes down to, in the book I discussed in one of the chapters, lazy thinking.
Yes, you do describe that.
At some point, there's consequences to lazy thinking.
And that has to be said. That's an actual powerful, in fact, very truthful statement. When you have lazy statements, if lazy thinking, we come up with problems, and that's something we have to pay attention to.
People forget, if you make a mistake in raising by the wrong color of car, what are the consequences of that? There might not be very many other than you don't like the color of your car. If you get the wrong engine size or choose the wrong stereo, or you bought the wrong dress, you went to the wedding wearing the wrong outfit, there's consequences, little ones, to that. If they're not good shots. But we're now dealing with some very big, important questions, and you cannot be lazy about that. But the consequences are very great.
You quote Zudi Jasser saying some very interesting things too. I've read a lot of Zudi Jasser stuff, and these couple of things caught me. I didn't expect. Now I've caught him saying some of this stuff. I don't normally see these two together. This says it starts out that the true nature of Islam is violent towards non-believers, and
Let me. He didn't say that the true nature of Islam is violence, but underneath that, I wrote what he said is that Islam.
That's what I was going to say. Islamic scholars and literature and doctrine inform us that the true nature of Islam is violent toward non-believers.
Yes. He's not saying it. He's saying that Islam's doctrine and scholars tell us that Islam is violent towards.
And then you catch him saying Islam is compatible with the U.S. Constitution. Now, I guess that's what got me, the contradiction there. He also says some Islamic doctrines and Muslim scholars are violently opposed to non-Muslims.
Correct.
So are these contradictions?
He hasn't even contradicted himself, and the reason is, and I'll explain that, it's very difficult to understand. He said in the book several times, my Islam. And I mentioned that. Because of my Islam. Islam that I live. So Islam is not in contradiction with the Constitution of Canada, of the U.S., is not in contradiction with Zuni Jasmine. That's what he made the mistake. A little. So there's two issues. In reality, the reformers, Zuni Jasmine, or Shamanji, there are two Islams. There's mainstream Islam, and then there is the reformed progressive Islam. So in their mind, their reality, their Islam is the true Islam. Their Islam, they say, is the Islam of the Prophet Muhammad and the Caliphate, the Rashidun and the companions. And that the Islam of Surah Phillips and Surah Al-Wahaj, the word of Islam, is the bad Islam. The mainstream Islam is the bad Islam.
According to the progressives.
According to the progressives, right. So when they say Islam is compatible with the American Constitution, they're not saying a lie, because because religion is a personal experience with you and belief, correct? It's your inner belief. It's your religion. It's what you believe. So can we say that Judy Jasser and Rishad Manji are wrong to believe what they believe? Because they're complete with belief. But then we can't say that the law is probably believe either. So we just have two people who believe two different things. Neither is right and neither is wrong. I mean, that's a conversation for people above my pay grade. That's not for me to decide. But the fact remains, 97% of Muslims in the world seem to prefer Islam of the law of. And they're on the scale of the law of Phillips, Sunni as well. That's the reality.
That's quite a statement. I think I'm going to have to swallow. I knew this was going to be your answer. And every time I hear you talk like this, I have to stop and think, because it's not an answer many expect. But I think it's an important.
What would the answer that you could expect?
I know you well, so I'm not going to take you down the. Every time I hear this, it's not. I always look at what does Islamic scriptures, what do the hadiths, what does the Sharia say, and if whoever's saying whatever, I want to see if what they're saying lines up with what their scriptures say. In Christianity and Judaism, here's the difference between Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. All right. Somebody can preach to you, but it is the person's job sitting in the pew. It is their job to read the scriptures and check and see if the person preaching to them from the pulpit or wherever, if they're accurate. That is the Christian's job. They're not supposed to just take what the pastor says for fact. That's the difference. And this is, you know, and I understand Islam is very different. That in general, what did we come up? There was a figure that Usama was just quoting. Oh my gosh, it was like 78% of all of Islam has never read the Quran, because they're not allowed to read it in their own language.
Well, I wouldn't go. No, I personally would stay away from that statement. I'm not sure what the value is there.
But that says, I'm just saying that says something about the difference in the belief. See, in Christianity, again, there's no requirement to read the Bible, but there is a compulsion to read it. In Islam, there's a compulsion to quote the Quran in Arabic, but you don't know what you're saying. That's what I'm getting at. And that they don't look for the translation because they're told that it's corrupt in any translation except for in Arabic. So I'm not disagreeing with that statement except for one particular translation. But that, I think, is a huge difference between Christianity and Judaism. What did the scholars say? Which, again, I'm looking at the Hadiths. What did Muhammad supposedly say? Again, looking at the Hadiths. What did Allah supposedly say? I'm looking at the Quran. If I look at those things, that's to me is the huge difference. But I want to get through these questions and before I go off target too much more, because I do want to get to Professor Manji. Now, for those in the United States, Professor Manji is not as well known unless we look at the LGBTQ, whatever letters they want to add to that community. And when Eric first started talking about her, I did tell him I'd never heard of her before, and I had to go look her up. And I was rather appalled. I was shocked. I had not heard of a... It was a concept out of my understanding. A lesbian, this is public. I mean, she's very, very public. And where was she broadcasting as a reporter out of Toronto? Was it Toronto?
Yes, she was
from Toronto. Is a lesbian reporter, correct?
She wasn't a reporter. She was a speechwriter and a pundit of the NDP. She ended up debating with... on a program with Shabir Ali
and Steve Bacon. With Shabir
Ali, wow. On a weekly or monthly basis, they would have a sort of crossfire, I think.
Wow.
She was a minor, she was definitely a minor personality.
I didn't think about putting those two together. I guess you mentioned it. I missed it. I'm going to go back and look. So here's the thing that he caught about, this is the statement he makes about Professor Manji, and again, it's a quote from her. She says that instead of acknowledging a serious problem with the guts of this religion, we reflexively romanticize Islam. She also says, I began to grasp how Islam came to be an insular, often hateful religion. Again, I do want people to understand Canadian law is very different than American law. And in his book, this is extremely important to grasp. In the United States, we don't really have laws against hate speech. We do have laws against crimes that are incited by hate. And I can what she said, that Islam can be an insular, often hateful religion, and would Canadian law forbid that?
You're on the border. So maybe yes, maybe no, depends on the claims, depends on the advert before and after, so everything is great. So, awesome, absolutely. But if I may, the whole idea of Islamophobia is an interesting exercise. But the bigger issue is what she just said. She said Islam is a really poor fact, which is an insular, often hateful religion. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Well, that in itself is quite interesting. That in itself should make people say, what's wrong? I want to know more about what they're saying. if what you're saying is true, then what?
Wow.
Unless you say you're a liar, she's a liar. No, it's not true. Okay. But she's a professor. A lesbian. Heralded by the left. And she's a champion. So this is what she said. So what's happening here, and you know, finally I'm putting it together in the book, we, you, Paul, everyone else, we don't need to know anything about these things. We don't really need to know. That's why I stay expert on the Quran. Really. If you get into an argument now about the Quran, this Quran, that Quran, what's, you know, who interpreted the Quran, maybe, okay, you're right, I don't know anything about the Quran, I'm not Arabic, and I don't need to. I don't want to get into an argument anymore. Let's listen to what Ursula Manji says. Let's hear what Rumi Jasper says. Let's hear what the imams themselves say about Rumi Jasper and Ursula Manji. Because now no one can argue about the public. They say, right, if you fall, what to say, whatever reason you want to say about Islam. Maybe right, maybe true, maybe correct. But they, whoever they are, will still argue with you because they don't like what you say. And if they don't like what you say, they're going to try to find something to discredit what you say. They're going to try. Is it right? Is it wrong? No, of course not. Is it right or wrong what the Democrats do, especially what CNN does? Maybe not. But it's a fact. So you don't need to be an expert in the Hadith. You don't need to be an expert in the Quran. Listen, just repeat what Rumi Jasper says, repeat what Ursula Manji says, repeat what Bilal Philip says. And juxtapose those two together and say, well, we have an issue. Maybe we need to understand how Islam is contributing to the development of our civilization and our society. Because it definitely is doing that. It's contributing. Now, is it contributing in the way you like? Maybe. Maybe not. There might be some people who love the direction civilization is going in. And there might be others who, if they really understood the direction that is being taken, might have qualms or second thoughts. Now, very important in the book, and you didn't pick up on that, because there's so much to pick up on. And this came from Ursula Manji. She was on one of her speaking engagements somewhere, and a man came to her and told her that he don't, because actually, she makes sense sometimes. And sometimes I like her, and I think what she says is she's honest. And she's smart. She's intelligent. A man told her that he donated money to build a mosque in his neighborhood because the people who were against the mosque were hateful people and they were right-wingers. Therefore, he donated the money to build the mosque. So Ursula Manji asked him, oh, really? Well, before you did that, did you find out what this mosque preaches? Are they LGBTQ friendly? Do they have a curtain? Do they segregate men and women? Did you find out that they preach hate against Jews? And the man said, no, I didn't. And for Ursula Manji, actually, you know, dressed them down, said they protest. So, but what I took from that, which was an example, a perfect example of what is happening, is it could be that sometimes people take the opposite tack or the opposite position that you take simply because they don't like them. Or someone could take the position that you take simply because they do like you. And you don't want that. You don't want people to agree with you only because they like you, right?
Agreed.
And you don't want people to disagree with you because they don't like you, because it makes no sense. And that's where we are. Very often people index.
Well, we had, I mean, that very example you're talking about, taking a stance one way or the other just because they like or dislike, we saw that in the last election. We saw people who just didn't like in the United States. We saw the election with Trump. So we saw people specifically saying, well, I don't like him because he's Trump Oh, I don't like him. And they would vote for Mr. Dementia. I can't tell you how many people I know that did that. Simply, they didn't believe that Joe had any talent. They didn't believe he would do any good. They just didn't want Trump, and that's why they voted for that. When I asked them, was there anything? No, I know he has dementia. Like,
so did you ever hear that expression? You're cutting your nose to spite the state.
Yes.
Well, there you go. So sometimes people don't care. They just want to be against you or whoever you happen to speak.
I did read the story you're talking about. I remember that in the book. That's powerful, by the way.
That's good.
Yeah. It says something to me. Again, I see it as contradiction of her beliefs, but it says something to me that she – and there's some honesty here, which I have to – which kind of – I'll admit, it shocks me that she holds this belief that, if you're going to say you're going to give this money – this is one of the things I really like about it is that she said, did you check to see these things? Did you check to see if they really are an inclusive? I don't know if she used this word exactly because I can't remember. She's really asking about the inclusivity of the mosque. If would you agree with that term?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. And she's talking about how women are treated. She's talking about the homosexual community, how they are treated. And there's more in that statement. I would go so far as to say, if you're going to give money to a mosque, one of the things I would recommend, if you just want to go towards the building, today I would say, look and see who the finances are behind the mosque. In general, you can do this through your county. You don't need a FOIA to do it. You can go to York, in the United States, I should say. Yeah.
But the more important point that we're making here is if we make the argument from our perspective, the person who we're arguing with can accept or often reject what we're saying simply because it is coming from us.
Yes. I'm taking her side, Manji's point. This point. So I'm taking her point. I think she is 100% accurate here. Look where that money is coming from. Look at those. Look at, what example are they setting?
The person part of that story is not her. It's that the guy was supporting the mosque only because people he doesn't like are against the mosque.
Yes.
That's
for me. So now the question for me, which I think would be more important, would have been his response, his answer to that.
No, I didn't check anything because all he was interested in was cutting the.
Yeah, that I get, but I.
To the people who were against the mosque.
But what to me would have been more important would have been, what did he think hearing that?
Again, please, you're coming back to what you were trying to. Whether it is or it isn't, the point remains, how many people that you speak to, but you, whoever that we speak to, on any subject, are against what we're saying only because it's we who are saying it. So when we remove ourselves from the argument or from the information, it's now neutral. And it makes it more difficult for people to be against neutral information. It's just information. So if I were to say, I'm going to tell you about how bad Islam is and what it does to homosexuals, etc., people who know who I am or people who don't like me want to reject information that comes from me. But if I'm sharing with you information that comes from Nima, or that comes from Rosh Hashanah,
well, in some respects, she was taking your opinion on that, is what I'm saying.
Yes.
So that's why, I do like that statement of hers. I'm kind of...
She makes lots of statements that are not saintly sentences. So this Jasser, they say something that makes sense. Jasser said very clearly that many mosques don't preach violence, but they are the precursor to people who become violent. Many mosques.
Wow.
Not some mosques, many mosques.
Many, yeah.
Yeah. He said that. Oh, but where he's coming from, he believes that the mainstream Islam is wrong. And that his Islam, the original Islam, is a beautiful, wonderful, accepting, tolerant religion that embraces Western values. Now, you might say that that's kind of bizarre because Western values are Western because they're not Eastern, right? Western Judeo-Christian values are Judeo, they're not Muslim, Eastern, Chinese, Asian values. But in his mind, they're one and the same.
While we're on that topic, I've gotten a few questions about your shirt, and it says pride. What was the word on the bottom?
Mubarak.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
Can you talk to us about that?
Mubarak means blessed, and everyone knows what pride means, right?
Yeah.
And you see the colors, of course. And that's the crescent moon. And Justin Trudeau, 3-4 years ago, at the Great Pride festivity, he said, and blessed pride Mubarak for everyone. He said that. Maybe not realizing what he was saying. And so we designed these t-shirts. And of course I have a website which is called fightislamophobia.ca in which we help people understand what it is that Muslim scholars are teaching and preaching.
Love it. Love it. Eric, I want to say thank you for all your hard work. I like your perspective. I don't always agree with it, but it's incredibly important. I like the way you present the material, and like I say, your writing quality it's just gone leaps and bounds. I know you've been working hard on this for quite a while, and I really cannot wait to see it in print.
I'm kind of getting fired of working on this. I want to get it over with at some point, right?
Oh, I'm like I say, I want it now. I want it out now. That's me.
I'd like to just say one thing before we go. We have to ask ourselves why it is that we want to talk about an issue. Is it to talk about the issue in order for us to demonstrate our knowledge about the issue, or is it to get other people to reconsider their position on an issue?
It's a good point. Yeah. Eric, anybody else have a question while Eric is still with us?
No, I just wanted to say thank you for coming on, Eric.
Oh. I see him.
That's Darcy, yeah.
Campbell.
Yes.
Oh, okay, well, you're most welcome. And salam alaikum.
It's
Alhamdulillah.
God is a surprising person, so I want to say again, thank you, Eric. Tell people where they can follow and support your work, too, please.
I read a lot on these issues on ericbrazil.com, which is my blog.
Oh, what was that last article? You just sent it to me. The last one you just wrote.
Oh, about the show, about the Albuquerque.
Yeah, that was well done, too.
For Muslims and care. So care features prominently in that article.
And I don't know if everybody's paying attention, but Robert Spencer just did a big piece on it. There's a lot of people talking about that. The one that Biden said, even Biden got weighed in on it and said it was a hate crime. It turned out it was done by another Muslim. just Sunnis versus Shiites again.
Well, we have to ask ourselves, what happened to them? Well, they at some point were going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan between Sunni and Shia and Iraq. Could that come to North America as the numbers increase?
Well, we've just seen that not once, but I would say multiple times. In fact, if we look at what happened with Salman Rushdie, we could almost say, we could almost throw that in there. Although they did put a fatwa against him, and that's a Shiite fatwa, that Sunnis and Shiites were willing to commit.
Well, there's no fatwa against the J.K. Rowling supporting.
Oh, wow.
Yes, because she wrote a tweet to support Salman Rushdie. And so they put now a fatwa on her. So, in essence, anyone now who even speaks out of people who have been, you know, murdered, will in themselves be now targets. So how, what could be done about that? I mean, in reality, wow. But at some point, we need to open up the numbers, and because there's a lot of people on the fence, correct, Paul?
Yes.
That's who we need to speak to and ask them if they are pleased with the cultural enrichment that the Islamic community is helping, you know, us move along toward. That's why we need to use cultural enrichment, because they are enriching our culture. Now, some will say that they're enriching it in a manner that some people prefer it would not be enriched. But then again, that's another conversation.
Yes.
So we have to open up the conversations. And we can only do that by not turning people off.
So not personalizing it is what you're continually pointing out.
The only thing left is not personal life, because all that the other side has left is to attack personally. That's what the other side does. So once you take that out of the equation, it's not there.
Which,
so now, go ahead, sorry.
I think that is the majority of what the people on the network that I work with, like Eric Smith and many others do. Our goal is not to personalize thing. It is to deliver a message communicating our sources, which prove that they're not, it's not just us. But I like your point about the personalization too. I have to admit, it got me really frustrated the first time I heard it. And I know that might have been one of our conversations where I got mad. But yes, you're right.
But I'd like to add even further, is you use your sources to prove. Use the word and the idea of to prove something. If you want to prove something, that means people know you have an agenda. And to some extent, they can take your cherry-picked information to prove your agenda. I'm not saying that it's good. And we argue that that's what you want. So they already come in, they can say you're coming into this with a bias against this. And you want to prove that. So my book, what I've tried to do, and what I try to approach this in the last 5 years, is I'm neither for, I'm neither against. I just want to learn and understand. And as I'm learning and understanding, well, I'm still not understanding because I'm still learning. Maybe 10 years from now, I'll understand. But until then, I'm just learning. And then I share with you what I learned. And together, ensemble, we will march down the road on the journey of learning. Nothing more, nothing less. I think that might sound a little too simple-minded, but it's almost like, you know, I'm Bambi in the woods, just taking a walk, and I, you know, I see a little bit of this Islam and that Islam, and this Imam says that, and this, the former says this, and I put it all together. And then I present it to you. And together, innocently, we will see what the people think. that the people in to some extent are the Germans. So we present it to them, and then ultimately some people will inevitably have to come to a conclusion. But if they suspect that we are trying to push them to conclude something, that's when they start to resist. People don't like to be sold. People like to buy. They don't like to be sold. That's kind of like my wisdom that I've come to at this point. So on that, I'll say good night to everybody.
Okay. God bless.
We'll
have to have you back definitely a week or two before that book comes out, because I'll do everything I can to help you get out there. I think you're doing a great job. Thank you
so much. And good night to all your listeners. Okay, bye.
All right. God bless y'all. I have to say the topic is hot. It's some people may not understand his point of view, and I will admit it wasn't easy for me. But Eric and I have been talking back and forth for a few years, and there are times I get heated. And he wants me to understand. This is the thing I like about Eric. He's willing to take the time to make me grasp the point of view or where he's coming from. And a lot of times I just have to sit there and bite the bullet and say, okay, I like your opinion. I like where you're coming from. I just have to figure it out for myself how you get there. It's very, very interesting.
Right. I'll have to listen to this again later.
And the thing to remember is he knows more than, I would say, almost everybody else in this continent. In the continent. Because he's one of the only people that's really been arrested for Islamophobia and jailed for it.
Wow.
So,
wow.
So the joke that went out is I have felons on my show. Well, Eric Brazeau is a guy who, when you tell the truth, sometimes there's penalties and people don't like it. Well, what he got in trouble for was basically telling the truth. And I think the importance of this book is that it will reach the leftists. It will reach deep into their hearts because of the way truth has to be presented to them. And I would say he's right about that. The manner in which he goes about it is what I would say is non-judgmental. That's times I get frustrated with it. I'll be honest, I do. There's times I'd like to put it differently. But again, I like how he does this. So that's one of the reasons I will do everything I can to support him. I think his work is actually very important. Watch for, I would say, subscribe to his blog spot or his blog. It's very, very, again, I will not say that you're not going to get angry sometimes, because he takes a twist on things that makes you think, and sometimes it's frustrating. But if you grasp what he's trying to communicate, it will blow your mind because it's a different way and it reaches a different audience. Now, I do want to address Samuel Kowalski said something, and I did want to address it. How do you tell the difference between a moderate person versus jihadi by the word or pen or what he calls taqiyya? And I'm going to bring this other guy up that he mentioned. He says, look at Dr. Oz. He's supposedly moderate, but demanded his opponent not criticize anything Islamic. That is a demand to obey Sharia. Now, for those of you unaware, both myself and Usama Dakdak have made enough statements against how dangerous this Dr. Oz is in his pushing of Sharia here. I have made numerous statements where I think this guy is, I mean, my biggest problem with Dr. Oz is he was Army, not for the United States, but for Turkey. he served in the Turkish army. While he was a citizen of the United States, and Turkey is technically, this is the problem I have with NATO. Technically, if you're a part of NATO, you're an ally. However, under Erdogan, Turkey is not an ally of any European country. Turkey is not an ally of anyone in NATO. In fact, Turkey places threats against their European neighbors. And this is done quite often. And he does threaten it for the purpose of receiving income. If you are surprised at that, my suggestion is you pay attention to what he's saying. I've done several shows on some of the threats he's made. So I need to come back to answer that question, though, the difference. The real difference is when we look at the Muslim Brotherhood calls civilization jihadis versus the concept of an Al-Qaeda jihadi. An Al-Qaeda jihadi wants things changed today. I should say yesterday. So they're willing to kill themselves over it. The civilization jihadi is willing to wait things out and it's okay that you die. So can't... the civilization jihadi is willing to wait you out until, or willing to outpopulate you until they get to a certain percentage of the population. We're going to start seeing that experiment about population percentage become a very real thing in the near future. Within 20 to 30 years, it is predicted that Denmark, it used to be 40 years. The prediction used to be 40 years. It's lowering because of the large increase in followers of Islam. And I wish that wasn't necessarily true. The percentage they're at, once you get over 20%, which is they're now over that percentage in Denmark. In France, which is one of the most populous Islamic, in terms of Islam, countries, they're afraid to express their opinion on a public street or in a public forum, lest violence happen to them. Now, I am saying this as somebody who was there in 2016, spoke with journalists, spoke with government officials, and I'm saying this as someone who still communicates with people in European countries. They are afraid to communicate where they stand. If we continue down the road we're going, where we have Mr. Dementia bringing in 100,000 people illegally that follow Islam into the country, what can be done? Do we ship them all 100,000 back? Technically, they're not U.S. citizens. There's nothing wrong with us shipping them back. It's an illegal action to bring 100 to bring them here, because first of all those who didn't pass the simple test. What are we talking about? It's a year-long examination, people. It's at least a year to 3 years to do a security check. And by the way, just to let you know, there are several that failed that exam, the first look. And I know Eric might understand this, and many might not, but there are ways to identify terrorists. And, you know, that they can do it by looking at facial, looking at they can just identify using computer-generated things. Here's a terrorist. He's been identified by certain things. And you know what? We brought several here that were identified as terrorists through that Joe Biden airlift from Afghanistan. And I don't know what else to say about that. There's actual FOIAs filed by congressional representatives to find out how many failed and how many terrorists they brought into the country. And where are they today? We don't have those answers. And with that said, I'm going to come back to something Protestant believers said. Nihad Awad, executive director. There is no justification to take an innocent life in our faith. The part you don't know, innocent is only regarded as Muslim, according to Nihad. Well, Anjum Chaudhry said, live on television, innocent means Muslim. Because if you're not Muslim, you don't accept Allah, which means you're guilty. Oh. And that was right after he was asked to, 7/7 had just happened recently when he made that statement. And there was a reference to innocents being killed. And he was talking about they are innocent because they're not Muslim. People don't realize that. That was, we have to pay attention. Again, this is what Eric Brazil was saying. What are they teaching in the mosques? We have to pay attention. We have to play those tapes. I had a couple I was going to play today, and I have been kind of busy lately, so unfortunately I did not prepare those, the ones that I've been looking at. I want to recommend one of those places you can look at, which is simply go to memory.org. Okay. Just catching up on everything. Yes, France is gone. France is repeating history. Thank you. Well said, people. I can hear the wailing and whining beginning if we shift them back. You know, I'm looking at it from a perspective of the law says you cannot come here. You're not legally a refugee. When you come into this country, you can't enter this country and then be a refugee. That's what, if you look at things legally, the only place you could come from another country and come here and be a refugee. I'm not talking, you can't just come here to be a refugee unless you live in one of two countries, Canada or Mexico. So you can, that's what I'm getting at. Technically, you have to go to a nearby country. Or you have to, there's a lot of things that involve this. So this calling them refugees, this is the other thing over in Europe, you can tell who the audience is by how the European papers are written. If they think Americans or North Americans as a whole will be reading something, they use the word refugee when they're talking about the large population of followers of Islam in their countries. They use that term only when they think North Americans are reading. Because otherwise, you know what they call them? Right now, the followers of Islam in their countries? They call them economic migrants. They've been doing this since 2016. Since 2015, I should say. Since 2015. They have been calling them economic migrants. Actually, it might be farther back, 2014. During the beginning of the wave of ISIS. Yeah. That's the purpose of what they're saying. I wanted to address something else today, and I do want to get into it before I go too far off target. And that is the New York Times. I don't know if anybody paid attention to this one, and to me it's a huge, huge thing. And I'm going to put this one on the screen. I'm just honest reporting. I've got to get some of these guys back up to come and visit here again. But Honest Reporting did an incredible, incredible piece. If you're not familiar with Honest Reporting, you can go to honestreporting.com. And again, I'm not asking anybody to support my show because I'm not making any money doing this. But my goal here is to get the truth out. So let me share what they did. And they took down a New York Times reporter who has been lying to the public, and they didn't tell anyone. They did not tell one person. This is interesting. So here we go. They said, the fix is, and this is the title of the article that took down a New York Times reporter. The fix is in how, how Hitler praising Palestinians are warping Gaza conflict coverage. This is by Akiva Van Koningsveld. And I'm just going to change the screen just slightly. Okay, August 11th. So we're talking last week, and I missed this article last week. I think I read it, but I didn't expect it to do what it did. So let's get this down. In a rare show of criticism towards Hamas, the Associated Press on Tuesday accused the Gaza Strip rulers of trying to muzzle reporters operating the coastal enclave. Under the new rules issued by the U.S. designated terror organization, Palestinians applying for entry visas on behalf of foreign news outlets were told they must always accompany their colleagues and will be held responsible for what they produce. Oh, who are we talking about? Okay, go back up here. U.S. designated terror organization. Who could that be? Could we be talking about Hamas? Oh, could we be talking about the Palestinian Liberation Organization? Think about it. And they're going to be responsible for what the news people produce? Amongst other restrictions, yes, it was Hamas. Hamas ordered media not to report on Gazans killed by misfired Palestinian rockets and to blame Israel for the escalation with Iran-backed Palestinian Islamic Jihad. What? Why is this important? Keep listening. After the Foreign Press Association denounced the severe, unacceptable, and unjustifiable restriction on the freedom of the press, Hamas claimed it had abandoned the supposed policy change. Yet as the AP reported, Hamas has still signaled its expectations, which could have a chilling effect on critical coverage. Hamas's threat is but the latest attempt to intimidate journalists since it violently seized control of the Strip in 2007. The terror group requires all visiting reporters to have a regime-approved local sponsor overseeing their work, usually a Palestinian journalist or a translator hired by the media outlet. Wait a minute. So, again, their news story only goes out proved. Now, this word Palestinian, I hate this word. These are Muslims who live within Israel. There is no country named Palestine. That is a scam, people. That is a scam. This place is an Islamic-controlled area in Israel. To document the danger of this intimidation, Honest Reporting looked into some of the fixers who helped shape the Western coverage of the recent conflict between the Israel Defense Forces and Islamic terrorists in Gaza. Okay, let's keep going. New York Times, Fadi Hanouna urges missile attacks on Israel. Out of the 8 articles produced by the New York Times during the 3-day PIJ, Palestinian Islamic Jihad initiated conflict, 6 credit Fadi Hanouna as having contributed from Gaza City. Hanouna, a freelance producer and fixer, who has also been hired by the BBC, The Guardian, and Vice News, appears to be working to further the anti-Israel narrative promoted by the Palestinian terror organization. They seek the destruction of the world's only Jewish state. Anybody surprised? For one, he supports arch-terrorist Marwan Barghouti, having backed him repeatedly on his now-deleted Facebook profile prior to his incarceration. Barghouti co-founded and headed the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, an organization that murdered dozens of Israelis in suicide bombings and shooting attacks during the Second Intifada. Hanouna, moreover, made light of the escape from prison of members of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades and Palestinian Islamic Jihad in September of last year. Most of the escapees were serving life sentences for their roles in attacks on Israeli citizens. Make light of it. It's okay. They got out. Yeah. No such thing as Palestine. Yes, there is no such thing as Palestine. It is just an Islamic-controlled area of Israel. That's all it is. Palestine is not a real place. It exists in fantasy land. Please understand that. Again, that word Palestine, just for people to remember, it was an insult given against the Jews. That's extremely important to grasp. That name is supposed to be an insult against the Jews. And if you don't understand that, that's a problem. Because if it's an insult against the Jews, that's what the name was created for, here's the problem. All those people living in this area, are they Jewish? Because that's the history of the word. I still find it humorous. So when I meet somebody who claims to be Palestinian, point blank, are you Jewish? And they look at me. Why would you say that? Well, you said you're Palestinian. Palestine is a word that was created to insult Jews. Are you Jewish? That's not true. Go look it up. The history's there. It's truthful. All right, let's keep going. All right, get back to the page here. Sorry. And, oh boy. I think I went the wrong direction. Forgive me. And I have to go back. Oh, joy of joys. And I'll just skip out of this for now. I want you to think about that reporter who shared these things. Now, that reporter got fired. He got fired by the New York Times because honest reporting outed him. My question is, did the BBC fire him? Did these other organizations, The Guardian, fire him? Or is the BBC still coddling him knowing that he works also for Hamas? Says something. Are they allowed to put out an honest, I mean, if this guy could put out honest material that didn't have to get approved, if it was any different, that would be great. But if he's going to put out the same narrative after he finds out there's freedom and you're not going to get killed for telling the truth, these are things we have to stop and reflect on. Why do I say that? Because facts are important. We can't put out misinformation. And I'm going to try and get back to the other articles I have. So hold on a second here. I have, let's see. Another article I have, which I could not avoid. I saw this and kind of mentioned it earlier when we had Eric Brazo on. And I will post this link in the chat room. I love that I don't always read Robert Spencer's articles online, and there's a reason I don't. And that is usually he has a good number of people doing outstanding work, and it's their work he's sharing. But this one, Robert Spencer, this is probably one of your best pieces. I love it. And again, if you're unaware of what I'm talking about, let me pull this back up over here. Excuse me. Here we go. And I went to the wrong side. Come on, grow. Okay. So go to Front Page Magazine, this article, Biden and Harris rush to condemn hate crime, but Islamic killer is a Muslim. I thought this was hilarious. Forgive me. There's a reason why I think it's funny. And it's simply this. And let me get there. Curl this up a little bit. And that's too much. Okay. Biden and Harris rush to condemn hate crime, but Islamic killer is a Muslim. I love this piece. I love it. The Less View of the World is a series of fictions, fantasies, and delusions. Like all propaganda, the House of Cards would collapse in a second if it weren't constantly shored up with what leftists claim is evidence or proof of their that there's sanity. Men can be women. January 6th was an insurrection, and the rest is actually real. And so when four Muslims were shot dead in New Mexico, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris rushed to condemn the killings and declare piously that hate has no place in America. The Islamophobia narrative that Muslims are particularly victims of large-scale discrimination and harassment in the U.S. needs shoring up. But when the killer was identified, things blew up in their faces. Why? Because the truth was, it was a Sunni Muslim killing Shiites. Oh. And this is the important thing that I like that Eric mentioned. I hadn't even thought to bring this up today. What are we going to, is that coming here? Is that coming here to the States? I point blank am going to say, hey, we're the ones importing it. How can we say that we aren't? When you import rivalry, one of the things that's going on in France that they talk about a lot over in France and in European countries, when the Muslims come in in large groups, they've discovered that they're also importing something called tribalism. It's not something they knew they were doing. So this is important to understand. When I'm talking about tribalism, you've got one faction of the followers of Islam over here. You get another faction over here. And they don't like each other. Problem is, they have to share the same space. Does it work? Well, when they start to fight and you're able to separate them, yeah, it does. But if they're near each other, this is the thing with the Sunnis and the Shiites. They both consider each other apostates. Under, if we follow what Abu Bakr did, Abu Bakr and his people believed the Ridda Wars, and you'll see this said in Islamic communities, they would rather take part in a Ridda War before they take part in the jihad. They want to purify Islam. Now, that's from their sources. My suggestion, again, leave me out of it. Go look up Islamic sources. Look up histories. Altaberi's histories. I will say this. If you're going to pick up Altaberi's histories, be prepared. Do not let small children read these books. And this is the thing that shocked me when I was reading it. There is some very pornographic material inside Altaberi's histories. And you don't want to come upon that unaware. Amazingly enough, they're produced by the State University of New York. Yes, they are produced. They are published by the State University of New York. They're produced in Libland, right here in New York State. But they don't want the students reading them in high schools. Why don't they put them in the high schools? I mean, in where they could actually access them. Oh, because if they did, they might learn that Islam is not about peace. Again, these are published by the State University of New York. I would like to see them in every high school library. It would be an eye-opener. Because what they record as, again, I'm not for the pornographic material being in there, but I would rather have students looking for truth, find in an Islamic source, not something I provide, that they have to go look for the original source. I'd like to see them find it in an Islamic source. This is what is extremely important that you, again, this is where I agree with Eric Brazil and a lot of it leave us out. When we say we're giving you a source or we have a motive, I don't have a problem admitting I might have a motive of exposing Islam as evil. I don't have a problem saying that. But what I want you to do is do what I expect of Christians and Jews to do when they're in a church setting. Check to see if I'm telling you the facts or if I'm lying to you. Look at the sources I provide. So today I provided some links. Go check them out. See if I'm making this stuff up. And there's a lot more material out there. And today I'm not going to go into a ton of it, unfortunately, because I'm only down to like a few more minutes left, which is kind of mind-numbing. I thought, well, here I'd be done with it a lot of time. And, you know, I thought about this interview, and I was wondering how much longer. I don't want to expose all of Eric's book, because, to say, there are some real humdingers in there. You'll sit there and you'll be so I didn't want to. This, he has so much in there. It's just I keep going back to that, because Irshad Manji just still kind of shocks me, no matter how many times the concept of lesbianism and Islam still kind of, the fact that they can, that somebody can believe they can co-mingle. This is why I thought his interpretation of the concept of mainstream versus, it's what I would call fantasy land, but his interpretation of when they talk about my Islam, there's another problem with that. The concept of Islam being personal doesn't follow Islamic teachings. Now, for the question up there is, how can they get Eric's book? It's not out yet. Watch for it, I would say October, November. I think he's that close to publishing. I mean, I have watched this book evolve from some of its most, you know, from just the beginnings. And to say that Eric's work, his writing style, everything about his presentation in the written format, just kind of, there's so much growth. It's just mind-numbing. I recommend it. And when it's about to come out, I'm going to have him back on. So that's the one thing I will say. The concept, again, of which is really hard for me, I don't understand. This is the thing I have a problem with in general. I have a problem with two conflicting belief structures coexisting in the same spot. I'm not talking about two individuals. I'm talking about one individual who holds two conflicting beliefs. If you're going to hold those two beliefs at the same time, which according to everything we know about the brain, you can't hold those two conflicting beliefs at the same time. Something happens up here that causes severe issues cognitively and mentally. It creates mental illness. Oh, you know, start to think about some of these concepts that I'm talking about. You know, and they're talking about people having these it creates something called cognitive dissonance. And when you understand that, I mean, when you're in law enforcement, you understand that you can't have those conflicting beliefs. You can't hold both of them at the same time. You might be able to hold one second and one the other second, but you can't hold them at the same time unless there's something mentally, some kind of mental illness going on. It's not possible. This is the one, you know, reason why law enforcement officials are able to get to the truth by questioning. And it's another reason why they have difficulty with people who are known as sociopaths. Now, I mentioned the one topic I probably shouldn't get into, but I'm going to ask everybody here if you would go to Amazon.com, look up Paul Sutliff as an author, and go look at my book reviews. I have Charles Doyle, the troll of the world, who thinks he allowed to break laws and make slanderous accusations on YouTube. Now he has gone to my income streams and he's trying to affect my income. So I'm not saying I'm the world's best writer, but when you go and make false accusations against me on Amazon, don't think the lawyers aren't coming out. Because as I have contacted one who is one of the best in the state, and I understand that's why he's extremely expensive, goes beyond my personal means. I don't have that kind of money to put aside. I have friends with that kind of money, but I can't get myself to ask. Wow, I just can't. Although it's tempting, I don't believe in asking for cash for me. I'll ask it for kids. I'll ask it for other people, but not for me. So what I'm asking is go to Amazon, take a look at the incredible idiot Doyle, and look at his reviews. There's usually one review on each of my books that has a review already, and it is full of hate and nothing about the book. If you could report that, I would appreciate it. That to me is important. If you've read my book, I'm asking that you would now submit it. I'm only asking for an honest review of my books. I don't want anything different. I prefer if you don't like it, tell the truth. If you do like it, tell the truth. And be honest. I mean, one of my best critics is on there. A lot of times she'll give me one less star because she's a lot better editing than the people I hire for editing. And she's good criticism. So because of her work and her honesty, I now hire two or three editors. And I'm getting there. So, yeah, there's still a few on there, yep. The name of the book. Last book I have out is called The Cancer of Civilization Jihad. And you can find that one there. And once you go there, you can find my name. You can click on my name on Amazon, and you will be able to get to the other books that I have up there. So the big one that's new that's out there, he's actually gone to the Christian books, and I write biblical devotionals too, and he's actually gone to those where there are reviews, and he's writing nasty stuff there too. So which bothers me the most is that he's done it on a book for children, which really is disgusting. It was a devotional for boys. But yeah. So to say I'm disgusted is besides words. I'm just kind of, I'm sorry. I don't have any respect for this idiot troll. So before I leave tonight, I want to give some good news. Now, I'm not sure if anybody has heard of this site. I discovered it myself today. I think I'd heard of it before. I do want to share this link. There is some good news. Hi, Eric. So you're still at work? Was it a parent-teacher conference night?
Something like that.
Yeah, okay. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Boy. So my last article. Sorry. My last article. Good news. Illinois school districts reject DEM sex education standards. So this is, I think, probably the most important piece I've seen this week, and it's the best good news. This came out, and it was actually published originally in the Washington Stand. It says, congratulations to the school districts who are opting out of this program. Let's hope they are using a better option and not just a different, worse one. This is by Meg Kilganan, a senior fellow for education studies at Family Research Council. On August 10th, the Center Square reported that 96% of the school districts, 534 out of 554 in Illinois, have opted out of the state's proposed standards for sex ed in schools, including a bill authored, passed, and signed into law by Democrats, despite the fact that Illinois is considered one of the big three most liberal states in the nation. In May of 2021, Illinois Democrat lawmakers passed a bill that align the state standards with the National Sex Education Standards. The NSES were authored in part by the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the U.S., which brands itself as Sex Ed for Social Change and commits to working to dismantle the systems of power and oppression which perpetuate disparate sexual and reproductive health outcomes. The NSES contributors and viewers include individuals from far less special interest groups like Planned Parenthood, the number one abortion supplier in the country, and Southern Poverty Law Center. If you pay them, they'll name anybody a hate group. And the gender role stereotype may limit behavior, among other contentious goals. The standard further stipulates that third, fourth, and fifth graders should be able to describe the potential role of hormone blockers on young people who identify as transgender. Third, fourth, and fifth grade. Yeah, that's enough reason to take that curriculum and toss it in the garbage. Wow. Right, to think that I'm even... But the good news is, again, how many are we talking about? 96%. Again, that's 534 out of 554 districts. Here's the problem, people. There's still 20 districts in Illinois who think teaching children in third, fourth, and fifth grade about a positive use of hormone blockers is a good thing. If that doesn't shock you. Wow. I have to keep saying, pay attention to the stuff that's out there. Pay attention to the news that's out there. I'm going to say pick up my book, my last book, The Cancer of Civilization Jihad. Watch for stuff like this. I'm going to recommend, again, purchase this book if you want an accurate translation of the Quran. It's called The Genesis Quran by Usama Dakdak. And then join Eric and the Cross and the Crescent and others who promote the truth. And God bless you all. I'm going to say good night, everybody, and God bless. We'll see you soon. Bye.
God bless.
Thank you all.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. And end episode.